Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
A truly classic opening, if you ask me.
Did you know this originally had lyrics?
Really?
Yeah, there's a rare, I can't remember if it's on one of the DVDs or if I have some old VHS thing on it, but there's a version with lyrics that, for whatever reason, NBC decided, nah, that doesn't work.
Well, that's probably a good thing, since, I mean, the new one's so, the one without the lyrics, that is just so classic and so, you know, you've got the theremin in there and you've got that wonderful 60s sound.
Should we tell people that this is Star Trek month?
We should. We probably should, at least. Hey, we're people, it's Star Trek month.
Yay. And we're going to be tackling all of the Treks, even the ones that don't deserve it.
Okay, I'm looking forward to those, actually.
That would be Voyager and Enterprise for those listeners out
there. So, have you ever met a Star Trek fan that is such a huge Star Trek fan that merely watching Star Trek gives him about a half chub?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, I've met those too. I'm not one. I'll be honest, I'm not a huge Trek fan. But there are a couple of movies that would give me just a full-on raging boner.
You mean the ones that you can get at adamandeve.com?
Exactly. Star Trek, this ain't Star Trek 1 and 2 in a nice little combo pack. Right, just at the site alone would cost you about $40.
Right, but you can get it cheaper if you use the promo code STATIC. You can get 50% off of this item.
$20, two movies.
Plus free shipping.
Right.
Plus three free DVDs.
Three
more DVDs. And a special mystery gift that I can't tell you what it is because I don't know. It's randomized.
They won't tell us either. You know what's really, really cool? If you really, really get into this ain't Star Trek triple X parodies, then you can even, right there on Adam and Eve, you can add on for only about $30 the head honcho male masturbator.
Why not?
Which I've actually heard of. I've heard that it works well. I don't know. But we'll leave that to our listeners. So if you get
the
something
promo
like
code
that,
STATIC.
Exactly. And if you get anything like that, write us and let us know.
Yeah, because it's not like we're going to make fun of you. We're right here admitting we use adamandeve.com.
Who have we had as guests? We've had porn stars as guests. We've had one of the most prolific porn producers out there as a guest. I mean, we are... Look, I am, what do they call it? Sex forward, sex positive. I'm all for it. Do what you got to do.
And I have an article coming out in Hustler.
You do?
I'm not sure if it's, as we record this, I haven't been told yet whether it's going to be the next issue or the issue after that.
Okay.
They were, the last I'd spoken to my editor, they were in the process of slating it. So they got to get the pictures lined up and, you know,
What's the article cover?
Porns that shouldn't be porns.
Okay. Interesting.
A lot of them like 70s and 80s movies, almost all of them are from 70s and 80s. And I was watching these, you know, as porns. And
research, strictly research.
And I'm like, okay, I'm really getting, you know, the characters are really, really well written. Their acting is really good. The storyline is interesting. And then the story would just stop dead for 8 minutes to have a hardcore fuck scene.
Hmm.
And I actually just wanted the sex to be over so I could get back to the story that I was caring about.
So
these are porns that I think would have been better movies had they been straight out exploitation films and not porns.
Oh, okay. Give us an example and we can read about it in the article.
Well, for example, Sex World.
Okay.
It, on its surface, it's a Westworld parody.
Okay.
But it's got actual characters, there's actual depth, and there's actually a point to everything that they're doing about how fantasies should remain fantasies and bringing a fantasy into the real world can have real world ramifications.
Interesting.
And so it's an article about porns that shouldn't be porns. The title is called "You Got Movie in My Porn." No, you got porn in my movie.
Hmm.
you know, from the old.
Yeah, it's the old Reese's.
I thought it was kind of funny, but I'm not sure well that'll translate just in text.
Hopefully about as well as it translated here. You can see that I'm laughing hysterically.
Shut up, dickhead.
Nonetheless.
So, an article coming out in Hustler, and then you need to go to adamandeve.com, promo code static. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Now let's get back to Star Trek.
Well, there's not really much to go back to because Uhura, back in the day, had it going on.
Never got into her.
Really?
She never did nothing to me.
Yeah.
Now, Janis Rand wasn't too bad. But she was only in like the first six episodes because of some behind-the-scenes nonsense.
Okay.
She was supposedly sleeping with the head of Paramount at the time. And when they broke up, all of a sudden she saw her part vanish.
Oh, wow.
Her part was written for another character all of a sudden.
Oh, my.
That's supposed. That's never been confirmed, but that's what the rumor is of why Rand left the series kind of unceremoniously. She was clearly built up to be a supporting cast member. Then she wasn't there anymore with no explanation. She showed back up in the movies, but she never appeared back again in the TV series.
All righty. So let's start with where it all began, back in the original series of Star Trek.
1966.
1966. Two years prior to Woodstock, we're right in the middle of this. Star Trek kind of started with the hippie movement, didn't it?
Sort of. And you got to remember, this is even before the moon landing.
Right.
You got to remember.
Right. 3 years prior to the moon landing.
Yeah. So this kind of predates everything we know of science fiction. Most science fiction we know has an element of science fact in it because of stuff we know. The reason Star Trek has a weird element of science fact, and I know it's weird me saying Star Trek has fact in it, but it was just kind of decent writing. The people were able to predict this is probably where this shit's going to actually go in the future. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, it does. Well, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, who wrote much of it.
No, he did not. That's something we'll get into in a little bit of
Roddenberry.
Scott's trying to open a soda and hold his mic simultaneously. Exactly. So that's why this sounds weird.
I'm doing the best
weird.
I can. I apologize. But nonetheless, Roddenberry at least had some input.
He created it. And he claims it was his show. He only actually has the credits for, like, getting, remember, there's 79 original episodes, counting the Cage being syndicated, which we'll get into that in a little bit.
And okay? The Cage was
the original pilot with Captain Pike.
Okay.
Yes. And he created it and whatnot, as his quote was, "Wagon train to the stars." Basically, it's a Western, but it's in space.
Okay.
That's the other thing you got to remember about this show. Classic Star Trek, it was the first quote-unquote adult science fiction series. Because up to that point, sci-fi was like Captain Cody and the Space Rangers and, you know, things like that.
Patrol.
It was kids stuff. Science fiction was for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw science fiction was doing quite well at the movies and decided he could use the science fiction setting to do things that they couldn't do. You know, they couldn't talk about race issues on TV. But if you have the black alien and a white alien battling each other, you can talk about the racial divide in America, you know, in a somewhat subtler way.
And that brings us back to the character that I originally mentioned, Uhura, being a black woman on the bridge, groundbreaking at the time.
Well, in the original pilot, not black, but the second in command was originally a woman.
Oh, okay.
But the studio would not do that. A woman in charge in the 60s? Are you serious?
Right.
So they would not allow that. But yeah, well, you got to remember, not just black, in a totally interracial crew. You had a Russian, although he didn't appear till season two. You had an Asian. You had an Irishman.
Yep.
You had a Scotsman.
Yep.
You know, you had more or less a totally interracial crew. And something else, Star Trek groundbreaking, first interracial kiss on TV, Kirk and Uhura.
Really?
First interracial kiss on TV.
Now, when was that?
I think that was season two, so it would have been probably 67 or 68.
Okay.
But Southern TV stations refused to carry that episode because it might incite violence in like Alabama and that.
Oh, my.
So the NBC affiliates down south refused to carry that episode. That's how bad the racism was down there at the time. A white man kissing a black woman? No, we'll burn down our NBC affiliate if you show that.
Yeah, I can. Traveling through the South and stuff like that, it's certainly gotten a whole lot better. A whole lot better than it was. But I can see where that might cause some problems. So,
but okay.
Anyway.
Okay, about Roddenberry, though.
Okay.
He's one of those people that like to take credit for everything.
Okay.
And he called these, and this part's debatable whether he's right on an esoteric level. His characters, he created the original characters, but he would constantly rewrite other people's scripts because my characters wouldn't act like that. My characters wouldn't do that. My characters wouldn't talk like this. And he would rewrite other people's scripts and force them to keep their names on the things he rewrote.
Well, to be fair, he did create the characters. I can see.
But for one thing, one of his biggest problems was he never wanted any growth. He wanted, and we'll get into this a little bit more when we talk about Next Generation next week. But what Roddenberry wanted was a series with no continuity. That anyone could have never seen the show before, watch any random episode, and they get a complete story.
Ah.
That you do not have. And to do that, the characters can never grow.
This is true.
And that's what he wanted. The characters had to stay static. You knew if something bad was happening to Dr. McCoy, it would be all set right by the end of the episode because he's got to be good for next week. And that is part of the problem with what Roddenberry was. The characters never grew. They never evolved. They never became more than caricatures under Roddenberry. And whenever a writer like Richard Matheson or Harlan Ellison or D.C. Fontana or David Gerald would try and make these characters grow, Roddenberry would stop them and rewrite their scripts to know the characters have to stay static, no pun intended.
So this is why... You're right. We never really saw much character growth until the movies.
Right. And that was when Roddenberry had basically lost total control.
Ah, okay.
Which, again, we'll talk about that more because you can see exactly when he loses control of Next Generation. You can see exactly when that happens. And then Next Generation had the same problem, though.
Okay.
The characters never grew. You tell me that Captain Picard was a different character from Encounter at Farpoint to All Good Things. And... you'd be lying because he's the exact same character. Every single character is the exact same other than their physical appearance.
But they're still good characters.
I disagree with that, but we'll get that. That's a next week show.
Okay.
But whereas Deep Space Nine was where the characters grew and the characters evolved, and you'd hardly recognize those season 7 characters from their season 1 counterparts.
Okay.
And that was when Michael Piller was in charge.
So let's get back to the original series. How did it come about? Because, I mean, to go from having kid stuff science fiction on TV and not much any serious, and yes, I'm using serious in a very wide stripe when it comes to the original series, but...
No, I don't think you're that off. I mean, the thing everyone seems to remember about Star Trek are the bad episodes. Everyone seems to remember the goofy ones where they fought a god or an omnipotent being or the space hippies or the singing, you know, Spock getting mind controlled and having to sing and play a little lyre and stuff. Everyone remembers those. They don't remember the really awesome science fiction stories like Dagger of the Mind and City on the Edge of Forever and the Doomsday Machine and the Tholian Web. People don't seem to remember those. They remember what is arguably the worst episode of Star Trek ever, Spock's Brain. That's the kind of stupid shit they remember. And he's smirking right now, so I think he just remembered it.
Yeah, somewhat. Of course, there's always that the scene that I always think of with original Trek is that's why. Yeah,
I'm trying to open a soda. Damn it!
But nonetheless, the scene that I always remember is when Kirk and Spock fought one another.
A muck time.
Yes.
Yes, that would be a muck time with the.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, yes. And you've seen countless parodies of that over
Futurama
the years,
Futurama must have used that in dozens of episodes.
Oh, yes.
But you got to remember, one thing Roddenberry did, which was very smart, although the fact that he would constantly rewrite them kind of makes me believe it was someone else at Paramount that hired these people, was he hired good writers. Like the aforementioned Richard Matheson. You know... this is the guy that wrote I Am Legend and Legend of Hell House. And, I mean, this is a hardcore great writer.
Right. And Harlan Ellison is right up there with him, that is known for countless sci-fi titles.
Well, Ellison would kill you for calling him a sci-fi writer right there.
He's completely sci-fi.
He hates that word, sci-fi.
He's completely sci-fi. There's no...
And he says it shouldn't even be pronounced sci-fi. It's skiffy. The way it's spelled, it should be pronounced skiffy. But what, like, going back to Ellison, he wrote what is considered the best episode of Star Trek ever of any one of the series, and that's City on the Edge of Forever.
Okay.
And while it's a really good episode, it could have been a lot better.
How so?
If Roddenberry had not rewritten his script.
Okay.
Ellison's original script, which has been printed, so you can read what his original script was going to be, was so much better. It would have really transcended 60s television.
Hmm.
And Roddenberry didn't want that because it would have required character growth. Both Kirk and McCoy would have grown as characters, and he didn't want, and Roddenberry didn't want that.
You know, there is something to be said about that static character, though, especially if what you're looking for is a complete story and a nice short little burst, then there's almost something to be said for just having a character and understanding the character from beginning to end. It's, again, not that they're not likable characters. They're just, they don't really grow. And I think a lot of this large story arc, growing characters, I think that that's a recent development, at least in American television. I think that that's a recent development. Because were there shows on in the 60s where you did see that kind of growth in characters? I can't think of any, but I'm also...
In the 60s, probably not. In the 70s, yes. But you got to remember, look at it from a comic book perspective. A comic book character is constantly growing. You know, if you read Spider-Man at Christmas time, and then you read Spider-Man at next Christmas, a whole bunch of shit has happened to Spider-Man, and he's grown as a character. So if comic books, which are arguably at that time kid stuff,
right,
could do that, why couldn't a show aimed at adults? That's my point.
See, it could, but again, I think that they were still playing with the medium of TV as a whole, and I don't think that that had dawned on people. In fact, I wouldn't doubt it if there was somebody somewhere that just went, you know, this TV thing, yeah, it's here to stay and whatnot, but people aren't going to invest all that much into it.
Well, and to a degree, you would kind of bore out there with that people, there were certain executives in that didn't get it.
Right.
Because while he wanted everything to be episodic, there were little nods at continuity. And of course, so what did NBC do? Air the episodes out of the little bit of continuity that was there. Such as Chekhov first appears in the season 2 episode Mirror, Mirror.
Okay.
Problem is, that was supposed to be his like 5th or 6th appearance, but it was the first one that aired. So you've got a character that we're supposed to know appearing for the first time in an alternate fucking timeline.
Ah, okay.
You know? I think there was one episode where it was in like Chekhov's first regular continuity episode, and they mention it's like 3 episodes after Chekhov's been appearing. They mention how he just transferred on board. Okay, that was clearly supposed to be Chekhov's first episode, clearly. But he's already been in the previous 3 episodes, so that's airing out of order. The Man Trap was actually the first aired episode of Star Trek. Do you notice something missing there? The pilot.
Right.
That was the second aired episode, because they considered the Man Trap to be a stronger episode to start the series with. Problem is, Dr. McCoy's not in the pilot.
Right.
The costumes are totally different. Mm-hmm. The weapons are totally different. The sound effects are totally different. And Kirk's middle name is different. So all of a sudden, you've got the Man Trap. Oh, this is a cool new show. And then the next week, it's the same actors, but nothing else is the same. And then the third week, oh, we're back to the Man Trap kind of look.
There we go.
How did they think that would not throw viewers off?
You know, again, I think they were still just kind of playing with the medium of TV and didn't quite grasp it yet.
But even if you don't grasp that, how do you not air the pilot first? Pilot is clearly first. Not only is everything different, but most of the pilot is setting up all the shit that's to come.
I don't know.
I don't understand that decision. Why does the first episode actually have to air first?
But anyway.
But okay, so they made the original pilot called The Cage. starring no Captain Kirk. There was no Dr. McCoy.
Right.
It was Kirk, Scotty, or no, sorry.
No, Pike.
Pike, Spock, Scotty, and I think George Takei was there, but I don't think they ever actually named, I don't think Sulu had a name in that, okay. But I think George Takei was bumming around as well, like one of the red shirts or something. And it was called Too Cerebral by NBC. It was, you know, it was, you had to think too much about this. We want something a little more action-based, a little less thought-based.
Okay.
So Jeffrey Hunter, who played Captain Pike, couldn't commit to reshooting the other pilot. He had some movie deal. So they recast him and said, instead of just recasting the role, let's make a new character. And Captain Kirk was born. And then they shot Where No Man Has Gone Before, which is what we call the real pilot. Okay. Or the second episode, if you want to get around, down an air date order.
Okay.
And they still had these like woolen sweater costumes. Spock's ears look so weird because they clearly didn't have the makeup effect done properly. And you got to remember, still no Dr. McCoy. They had a different doctor. Do you ever watch Roseanne?
Yeah.
Remember David's abusive drunk mother?
Barely, but yes.
She was the original doctor in the pilot of Star Trek.
Oh, wow.
she was weird. The first doctor in Star Trek. And then she ends up getting killed in the pilot. And then Dr. McCoy shows up in, continuity-wise, episode 2, The Man Trap. And then, you know, he's there ever since. And they formed what is called the Triumvirate. You have Spock as logic and intelligence.
Right.
Kirk as impetuousness.
Okay.
And McCoy as heart.
All right.
So the three of them were called the Triumvirate of Emotions, which is why I always thought it was kind of disingenuous that only Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner got starring credit. DeForest Kelly and all the rest of them were also starring.
Yeah.
And their names weren't nearly as big a font in the opening, which I always thought was kind of an insult.
Which is a shame, because really, Bones, DeForest Kelly's character, was always my favorite.
I think he's one of the best characters in all of Star Trek.
Yes.
Because he was one that, and this is partially due to DeForest Kelly and partially due to, because his character was so good, he was the writer's favorite.
Ah, all right.
The writers admitted that they always get, you know, look at it this way. Go through all of classic Star Trek, including the movies. Who has all the best lines of dialogue?
Oh, McCoy.
Dr. McCoy.
McCoy by far.
Who has all the best comedy bits that actually work? Dr. McCoy. Dr. McCoy got all the best stuff because he was the favorite character. But you got to remember, Shatner had in his contract that he was the star.
Of course.
No, he actually, Harlan Ellison's related a story where he actually line counted. In Ellison's City on the Edge of Forever script, he line counted. Even though he was clearly the main character of the story, Spock had three more lines of dialogue than him, so he went to Roddenberry, who forced Ellison to do a rewrite, that Shatner's the star, you have to give him more lines than Nimoy. That's the kind of egomaniac Shatner was then.
Wow.
Yeah, he actually fucking line counted against Nimoy.
I think, I hope that Shatner has grown since then. Pretty sure he has.
I'm pretty sure he has, but back then that's ridiculous.
True.
But you know, look at Dr. McCoy. He's the only character that arguably acts totally human when you think about it.
Yeah, you're right. Because, I mean, Spock is obviously way too logical. He's only half human. And we can see where that comes from. Kirk, I always thought that Kirk, and this is why I never got into the original series. Kirk was too much like a man-child for me.
He's kind of a douchebag.
Yeah. He was kind of a jerk. He made, you know, drop of the hat type stupid decisions that I thought, and I always kind of wondered, how did Kirk become captain of a starship?
Which you find out in the movies later.
And then that's why when it comes to the original series, I'm not a big fan of the TV show. Love the movies.
See, before we move on to the movies, one more thing about the TV show is, as a kid, even, I was always interested to learn more about the Federation. and this world that they live in. Yes. I didn't want to see them fighting gods every week. I loved the episodes like Devil in the Dark where they fought the Horda. You saw all those like Federation miners and this mining colony, and in Dagger of the Mind, you saw a Federation insane asylum, and in Trouble with Tribbles, you had the Federation food platforms and all this. And I always liked the ones where they explored the other aspects of the Federation, which thankfully the movies gave us a little bit of.
Yeah.
Because that's something I always liked. Do we always have to concentrate on the same fucking characters? Can we do something else?
Now that would be an interesting deal for the next Trek series. Instead of grouping it around a ship or a space station such as DS9 or Voyager or the original series or Next Generation, call it Star Trek Federation.
Well, see, originally, before they made Enterprise, they wanted to do a Star Trek anthology series.
Before they made what?
That one that we'll get to in a few weeks.
I don't. But that one doesn't exist to me, but...
Fourth season's the only one that exists to me. But they wanted to do an anthology series, just like the Outer Limits, where it would be, one week it'd be an all Klingon story, one week it'd be an all Romulan story, one week it'd be a story that takes place in classic Trek continuity, one week it'd be something that takes place, you know, in the Delta Quadrant, in Voyager continuity and whatnot. It would be a total anthology series, and Paramount said, no, people need recurring characters. They need to know that every week they're going to see the same actors and the same characters. That reassures them as a series. So a Star Trek anthology, no go. I think that could have been a brilliant series that really would have opened up the Star Trek myths.
I think it could work now. I really think it could work now. Even in next gen time and stuff like that, I think Paramount made the right choice with the recurring characters. I think it could work now.
I don't. I would have loved the anthology series. But
I know. But that's what I'm saying. The next one, okay, producers that are listening out there, and I know you aren't. An anthology, call it Star Trek Federation. I've always been curious what's going on at Earth. What is Joe Schmo's life on Earth like?
Do you know what's really interesting? In the old role-playing game from classic Star Trek, do you know what the best-selling, and to this day people still buy this module, is? The Triangle. They didn't really get into this too much in classic Trek. It was mentioned every now and then, but the Orion Syndicate. It was basically the mafia in Star Trek. Deep Space Nine dealt with the Orion Syndicate quite a bit.
Okay.
But it was brought up, the Triangle. Okay, you've got up in one corner, you've got the Klingon Empire. Mm-hmm. Next to it, you've got the Romulan Empire, and then you've got the Federation. There was a triangle of space that nobody owned, and that's where basically the space mafia and the criminal element hung out. The Triangle is such a cool module and story that Trek fans still seek that one out. I think a Sopranos / Star Trek series could actually work pretty cool.
That could be interesting, but again, I've always been curious. I mean, throughout all of the Star Trek universe, throughout all of it, the people that have been center stage have been the military, Starfleet.
Right.
And even when we do get those glimpses of Earth and San Francisco and stuff like that, in, for instance, Star Trek IV, it's still centered around the military. Well, I've always been curious, what's going on with Bob Gunderson in the middle of...
You get a little bit more of that in Trek 3, which is something I liked about Search for Spock, is you got to see like a Federation bar.
Right.
And you got to see the inhabitants and, regular Starfleet security, not military, just
right.
Basically a Federation cop. You got to see a Federation trade ship, the one that the Klingons were smuggling the Genesis device on. You got to see a Federation restaurant,
but there have been glimpses.
But that's one thing I really liked about the movies is it did give us these little glimpses of the non-Starfleet aspects of the Federation.
I agree.
That's something I always liked.
But we're completely off topic of the original series.
Well, so the original series didn't do well in its original run.
No, it did not.
I mean, hell, it was actually canceled after season 2, but then the letter writing campaign saved it for one more season, which is generally considered the worst of the three seasons. Although I think the Tholian Web, one of their best episodes, that was from season three. So if nothing else, they gave us the Tholian Web.
Okay.
And then it was canceled. They had the animated series in the 70s, which, yeah, it was neither here nor there. It wasn't great. It wasn't.
That was one of those anime that you're kind of like, it existed.
The only thing I liked about the animated series over the original was, because it was all animated, it didn't matter about special effects. Yeah. They could tell stories. A dialogue scene would cost the same amount as a huge space battle scene.
This is true.
So it did open up things a lot more and was a lot more action-oriented, because it's going to cost the same to do the talky stuff from the show versus a huge Klingon-Romulan war.
Okay.
So that's the thing I did like about the cartoon. But, so yeah, the cartoon in the 70s, and then they were actually prepping a sequel series called Star Trek Phase 2. They had done costume tests. They had like a dozen or so scripts written. Then in 1977, a tiny little movie called Star Wars came out.
Didn't affect the world at all.
And all of a sudden Paramount said, instead of TV, let's take those Phase 2 scripts and let's make them into a movie. And keep in mind, none of the original characters at this point. This was supposed to be the Phase 2 characters.
Okay.
And then somehow it got decided, let's actually bring back the original characters and throw out all the Phase 2 characters.
So is that why the Star Trek The Motion Picture
looks so different?
One looks so, yes, radically. Okay.
Because those costumes, those were supposed to be the Phase 2 costumes, oh, okay, which is why they look, and I guess I know it was 79, but that's the reason they look so 70s.
Okay.
You know, those costumes, they look so mid-70s, because those were the designs for Star Trek Phase 2.
And of course, we were all shocked and amazed at the revelation of V'ger.
Okay, Harlan Ellison accurately described Star Trek The Motion Picture as Star Trek The Motionless Picture, because nothing happens. Now, Brad and I recently discussed this on a Radiodrome. I do believe that the motion picture is not a bad movie. It could use some tightening in the editing room, but I think it's better than 4. Well, definitely better than 5, which I want to forget happened.
Yeah, yeah. It's better than some out there, but it is still, it's no 2.
Right, and 3. I love 3. Fuck everybody with this odd-numbered shit. 3 is a great movie.
3 was meh.
Fuck you. But, so Star Trek The Motion Picture came out. Oh, do you know who narrated the original trailer?
Who narrated the original trailer?
Orson Welles.
Really?
Yeah. Orson Welles narrated the original Star Trek trailer.
You're going to have to prove this to me.
The human adventure is just beginning.
What do you know?
Told you I wasn't lying. And then he's going to introduce each character and give a
William
little bit.
William Shatner, take us out, is Captain James T. Kirk.
And he's going to go through the whole cast.
Leonard Nimoy is Mr. Spock.
Yes, he is.
DeForest Kelly is Dr. Leonard Bones McCoy. James Doohan is Lieutenant Commander Montgomery Scott. George Takei is Lieutenant Commander Sulu.
Potter down there, Bunko.
Okay.
But so yeah, Orson Welles narrated the original teaser trailer.
But that's amazing. And my God, you're right. Looking at these costumes and looking at the special effects and the...
Well, see, here's the real ironic part about the motion picture.
Yes.
The tagline is the human adventure is beginning, something like that. The human adventure.
Right.
Well, there was no humans in the movie. I mean, let's be honest. The movie is totally, no pun intended, static. It's just, the characters are totally cardboard. The movie is all about its special effects, yet the tagline, the human adventure is just beginning.
Very true.
There's no emotion. There's no oomph to this movie at all. Admittedly, the special effects are really good. For the time. I still think they're pretty good.
I'm going to say for the time.
To me, the only character, and I hate to harp on this, that really comes across as a character is DeForest Kelly as Dr. McCoy.
Well, he was the favorite character.
But look at how, you got to remember the novels, that's the other thing we got to tell people. You wouldn't believe the Star Trek fandom between the series and the movie. All the comic books and the novelizations and things like that that were out and the role-playing game and whatnot.
Right, there was a lot of stuff out there, and I remember some of it, honestly.
Well, basically, McCoy had left Starfleet. He'd quit and gone and opened his own medical practice on Earth, which is why in the motion picture, when you first see him, he's got a big-ass Grizzly Adams beard.
Right.
And he's like, Bones, I thought you'd said you'd never set foot on a starship again. And he's like, they invoked a little-known, rarely used clause, you know, reactivation clause. In other words, the bastards drafted me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and, you know, and then he's got his whole rant about, you know, Kirk's like, Bones, there's a thing coming towards Earth. And he goes, why is every creature we don't understand automatically called a thing? And, you know, he's got the only real emotion in the movie.
This is true. And by the way, that is one thing where I give, and I don't know if Roddenberry should take credit for this or if other people should take credit for this. You'll probably know. Hang on, because you're already grimacing at me. Because all I have to say, watch this, Roddenberry. Oh, there it is. There it is.
Okay, go.
Nonetheless, a lot of this stuff that was in what in Star Wars you would consider the extended universe, like the books and stuff like that, with Star Trek, that extended Star Trek universe remained canon and remained canon well for a good chunk of it did.
Nope.
No.
Nope. They said right when the motion picture came out, if it didn't happen in the TV show or in a movie, didn't happen. That's the way it was all through Next Gen and Deep Space Nine's time, too.
Really?
Didn't matter. All them comic book stories, all the novels, if it didn't happen on screen, it didn't happen.
Really?
Yep, those were all what-if stories.
So I wonder,
and that was right from the beginning, Paramount. Those are all what-ifs.
Oh, I'm going to find my source that told me that and hit them in the head with a microphone then.
You know, if I do some digging, I can actually find a quote from them that says basically the books and the comics didn't happen.
Okay.
So it didn't matter what you read there, that doesn't affect the continuity of the show.
Ah, all right.
They even had a really cool 4-part miniseries of Next Generation versus Deep Space Nine crossover. That was pretty cool. They did that in the late 90s. Pretty interesting. Would have been cool if it had actually happened on the shows too, because that was the last season the two shows were running concurrently.
Okay.
But so classic Trek, you had the motion picture, which it didn't bomb, but it did not do well.
It was me.
And then so somebody decided, because he, part of the problem was hiring Robert Weiss to direct it.
Okay.
This is the guy that directed The Sound of Music.
Oh. Yeah, that's not...
He's not going to be making an exciting action pack. He's going to make a quality movie. He's going to be well-directed, well-edited. It's going to be well-acted, but it's not going to be an exciting film.
This is true.
I'm not, you know, this is the guy that made The Andromeda Strain. I love that movie,
but... I adore The Andromeda Strain.
It's hardly an exciting movie.
Right. It moves at a snail's pace.
And that's what motion picture did. Like I said, Harlan Ellison called it Star Trek the motionless picture, and that was accurate.
Yeah, very true.
But then they handed the reins over to Nicholas Meyer, and Roddenberry basically had totally lost control. He had no control. Oh, by the way, when they were trying to prep the movie, Harlan Ellison told the story. He put Roddenberry buried the hatchet, and he was willing to work for him again. And Paramount kept wanting bigger for the movie because we got to beat Star Wars. He's like, every plot we gave him, bigger. It's got to be bigger. He goes, in one of them, we blew up the entire universe. And they said, can you go bigger?
No.
That was the way Paramount was. Everything had to be bigger. And then when you see this movie, you go, that was the bigger?
Really? That was the one they settled on? Really?
Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess at the time, though, Voyager was kind of a novel thing. Because this was, you know, motion bit was what, 79?
79.
So we've come out of the space race at this point. We still have the big commie, the red curtain, so to speak, still kind of hanging over us. And NASA is still doing its thing of launching, you know, they go deep space. This is the time when Carl Sagan sent out the gold. Well, Carl and his
billions
wife.
Billions of stars.
Well, they sent out the golden record on Voyager and stuff like that. And this was the time when all of that would have been contemporary and fascinating. And we didn't know what the other side of Jupiter looked like. We didn't. We've never seen the other side of Saturn. See, and
I mean, I don't want to make this all a Star Trek: The Motion Picture rant,
right?
Because we don't have enough time. But you have to bring into the fact that the motion picture was doomed from the beginning.
Why is that?
Because nobody knew how to make it. Everybody wanted, well, we want a lot of special effects, but we want good characters and we want lots of scenes that people are going to remember. And then there was the whole nepotism angle. Basically, every non-main character was played by some Paramount executive's relative.
Oh, okay.
That's why some of the line deliveries are, there are Federation ships coming in. And it turns out that's the wife of the head of Paramount and stuff. I mean, Ellison went into huge detail in his book, Watching, about just the nepotism. He's like, well, that's so-and-so's secretary. That's the mistress to so-and-so.
Oh, wow.
That's so-and-so's little brother. You know, I mean, everyone said, well, all of our relatives want to be in a Star Trek thing. Why don't we? We got, you know, walk-on roles. Let's make them. You know, so the nepotism really brought the quality down on the acting.
But 2 years, what was it, 2 years later?
82, so 3 years later.
82, 3 years later, we got something amazingly special.
Nicholas Meyer gave us The Wrath of Khan.
Yes. This is by far my favorite Star Trek movie The Wrath of Khan.
See, the reason I like Wrath of Khan and three and four,
beyond
they
the
work as one long story.
Is Khan a genetically superior tyrant, exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up.
Played by Ricardo Montalban.
Again, this was probably what they did right. This is probably what they did right as they went back to the series.
Right.
You know, and from Khan's episode Space Seed.
Now, the other thing that I love Ricardo. Ricardo Montalban is, throughout his acting history, he's come across really, really well in Wrath of Khan, playing Khan Noonien Singh.
Battle for the Planet of the Apes, he was great.
For the Planet of the Apes, he was pretty good in. But then a lot of his other stuff, and especially a lot of the stuff around this time, he was either a commercial spokesman for Chrysler with the rich Corinthian leather, or he played comic roles.
Yeah.
Where he basically became a parody of himself. And that's one of the things that I like about Wrath of Khan is we look at Ricardo Montalban and about halfway through the movie, you forget that it's Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah, and you believe it's Khan.
Right, and you believe it's Khan.
Do you know what the link between Khan and Deep Space Nine is?
No.
Dr. Bashir was made from this, not the same genetic material as Khan, but the same genetic process. Because if you remember on Deep Space Nine, Dr. Bashir was genetically engineered.
Really?
Yep. Because they actually wanted to perfect the Khan process, and they actually mentioned Khan by name.
Huh.
But
I wonder why we never then saw Avery going, Bashir!
Because Bashir was a good guy?
Yeah, but, you know, you could still, I'm sure you could work that into a script, and that would be a fun little nod. Anyway.
But see, Wrath of Khan, the one thing that I can never get out of my head from Wrath of Khan is
the earbugs?
No, the huge continuity error that I consider unforgivable, that how did nobody at Paramount notice this?
Okay, what was that?
Chekhov recognizes Khan. Khan's episode was in season one. Chekhov didn't even come on board the Enterprise till season two. So how did the two characters recognize each other when they'd never met? And Khan has, I remember you. I always remember faces. No, you'd never met Chekhov. That to me is just,
Okay.
Well, see, what originally it was supposed to be Sulu. Was written for Sulu. And when they rewrote it for Chekhov, somebody should have noticed, but Chekhov wasn't on the show. I mean, hell, Walter Koenig could have said, but I've never met Ricardo before. So how could our characters have met?
Who knows?
So that always bothered me. The ear things always bugged the shit out of me, too.
Yeah, man, I got to tell you, I remember seeing this in the theater, and that was by far the creepiest scene ever. was when they put the ear things
in the helmets and put them on.
Yes.
Now, we only got 10 minutes left, so we kind of got to rush through the other films here.
Okay.
We fucked around way too long.
Two, really good. Three.
I loved it.
You like three.
Well, and not counting the Klingon's little appearance in the beginning of Motion Picture, it's the first time you really get to see what we'd call the modern look for Klingons.
Yeah, I'll give you
and,
that.
And, you know, the whole new, the Klingon society.
Three for me was kind of meh.
See, I liked three. I loved the destruction of the Enterprise,
right.
Which
okay,
was
good.
Okay, first you kill Spock in two.
Yep.
Then you blow up the Enterprise in
Incredible.
Three. And you just kind of like, holy shit, where are they going to go now?
Exactly. Then they come out and they hit four, which
is the most profitable of all the films because it was the most quote-unquote relatable.
Yeah.
Hey, at least they did not have the Eddie Murphy subplot.
Yeah.
Where he was supposed to be a phony TV psychic that saw the bird of prey landing, and he was running around chasing them the whole time trying to prove that they're real.
Oh, God. Thank God they didn't do
thank
that.
God, yeah, thank God that got killed.
I mean, four has its moments. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, four to me is more of a comedy than anything else.
Definitely.
You know, and there are some cool stuff. That's something that really pisses me off that never came back. The big probe. The big probe that was knocking everything out and communicating with the whales.
Yeah.
Why did that never get dealt with on, like, Next Generation?
Ever.
I never understood that.
Yeah, it just kind of disappeared. Five, we both agree, never should have existed.
Five is terrible. I mean, maybe it was Shatner's ego. Okay, right. It was Shatner's ego.
Yes.
But the main problem with five was the script. It was terrible. You know, first of all, he went for slapstick.
Right.
I mean, you've got Scotty hitting his head repeatedly, and you've got them singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And you know, and even then, maybe it's the Trek nerd in me, but nobody even researched what the Enterprise was.
Right.
You know, like I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it was like the Enterprise only has 30 decks, and Scotty's like, I'll be down on deck 37, Captain. What, are you going to be floating in space? Because there aren't 37 decks, and you're the fucking chief engineer. Shouldn't you know that?
My chief engineer sucked 37 decks.
You know, and 37?
I was wondering. In a row?
Hey, you get back here.
Sorry.
Try not to suck any decks on the way through the parking lot.
Oh, God. thank you for Clerk's Trek. Nonetheless,
but,
okay,
well, and
six.
No, well, hold on.
Okay.
Back to five quick.
Back to five.
And you brought up Uhura. Yeah. I did not need to see a 64-year-old woman doing that erotic fan dance.
No.
I didn't need to see that.
No. Uhura was hot back in the TOS days. No.
Not by Trek 5 era.
Not by Trek 5 era.
But then you got 6, which to most fans is called Star Trek 6 The Apology.
Okay, why is that?
Because it's apologizing for how bad 4 was. Five. Or 5 was.
There you go.
Oh, and MC5, one of the few movies I've ever walked out of. When they started shooting God with photon torpedoes, I just said, that's it. I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore.
Okay.
I mean, I know there's only 10 minutes left in the movie, but I'm done. I can't deal with this anymore.
So what comes after 6?
Well, first, 6, damn good. 6 was a damn good story. One thing that I really, really liked was the fact that you'll notice throughout all the movies, not as much the TV series, but the TV series did it as well, but the movies really did it, where it became the movies starred Kirk and Spock, and everyone else was there to move their story along.
Right.
Even Dr. McCoy got pushed to the background constantly, which is why his great lines of dialogue always stood out even more, because it was basically a supporting cast member getting all the best lines. And they said, well, while Kirk and Spock are still a big part of this, they really roped Dr. McCoy into the main storyline for fucking once.
True.
Which I liked, by having Kirk and McCoy going to prison and Kirk and McCoy being on trial. And to not keep bringing up Deep Space Nine, there's a thing in Deep Space Nine we'll talk about in a couple of weeks called Section 31. It's basically like a secret CIA organization within the Federation that works behind the scenes and has no law that applies to them, okay?
Okay.
And they protect the Federation. They were the ones behind the attempted assassination of the Klingon president in Star Trek VI.
Oh.
They actually retconned that was a Section 31 mission.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But 6, really good.
So after 6.
Only thing I didn't like was that they didn't bring back Savick.
Really running long time.
I know.
Time.
Kim Cattrall's character was supposed to be Savick from 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
Or but they decided because of her betrayal that that was kind of betraying the character.
Okay.
So they just decided to make it a new character. And, of course, Christian Slater is in that movie. So you have Christian Slater in Star Trek.
Which is kind of cool because I like Christian Slater.
Yeah, it was a little uncredited. You know why he's in that?
Why is he in that?
His mom was the casting director.
Really? That's cool.
Mary Jo Slater is his mom.
Hmm.
Okay, and then you've got what I consider a really terrible movie, which will bridge into next week's topic, is Generations.
So I'll tell you what. Generations is considered the first of the Next Generation movies.
I consider it the last of the classic Trek movies at the same time. To me, it's both. It's a bad movie no matter how you look at it. It's not well written. It is not well made.
Right. So I say we save that till next week. But I actually, here, right at the very end of the episode, I've always been curious. When it comes to casting, you always see casting by blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
What's CSA stand for?
Probably the Casting Something Association.
Casting Something Association?
I don't know what the A, I don't know what the.
I've never been able to
S
find it.
S stands for. I don't know.
Never been able to find it.
Well, and then now they tried to give Sulu his own TV series in the late 90s.
Really?
Yes. This is before they were going to go with Voyager.
Okay.
But they couldn't find good enough scripts, which is why one of the scripts that you saw on Voyager was a Sulu episode, a Sulu flashback episode when he appeared on Voyager. Mm-hmm. But there was a huge divide in Star Trek VI between Shatner and T'Kay. The fact that Sulu became a captain and got his own ship of the Excelsior.
That pissed off Shatner.
Because there's another... I mean, you know, Spock had been a captain earlier, but it was the Enterprise, and he was still outranking him. Then he gets demoted to captain. Basically, he had this thing. None of those other guys should be the same level as Kirk. And so that actually pissed him off.
Well, to be fair,
that they, God forbid, promoted somebody to their own command.
No, one... Kirk by this time, wasn't he Admiral Kirk?
He was Admiral Kirk in one. He was Admiral Kirk in two, and then since three takes place right after two, and four takes place right after three.
Right.
They're one
story.
Yeah, that he was technically Admiral Kirk in all those, but at the end of four, he, because of all the things he did in two, three, and four, he gets busted back down to captain. Okay. So he becomes Captain Kirk again at the end of Trek 4.
Uh-huh.
That's the other cool thing that people don't seem to ever realize is there's no Enterprise in 4.
Yeah, I know.
Because the Enterprise blows up in 3 and they've got that stolen Klingon bird of prey entire time in 4.
Yeah.
Which I think is cool. Really, Paramount even re-released 2, 3, and 4 on one DVD called the Star Trek Trilogy.
Oh, okay.
Because it was one long story.
Yeah.
And I think... it is, and it works like that. It works as one long good story, and then 5 goes and muddles that up. And also the other Next Generation thing with Star Trek 6. Do you know who Kirk and McCoy's defense attorney was?
Who?
Worf's grandfather.
Really?
Played by Michael Dorn, and he's called Colonel Worf. So their Klingon defense attorney is Worf's grandfather.
Oh, that's cool.
And a nice little nod to continuity. And you know who this isn't actually part of continuity, but do you know who the assassin is that tries to assassinate the president?
No.
The actor that would go on to play Odo on Deep Space Nine.
Really?
That was Rene Abergenois.
Really? And didn't he have a part in Benson?
Yeah.
Back in the 80s?
I think so.
A very distinctive voice.
Yeah, but he, a lot of cartoons too.
Yes.
You know, he did a whole lot of cartoons for why can't I think of their name? The guy that did Ruby Spears. He did a lot of work for Ruby Spears and Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about him because he's always been a fascinating character for me. But and then they kind of muddled him up in the series toward the end.
Do you know who the president of the Federation was in 6?
No.
Kirkwood Smith. The villain from RoboCop and the asshole dad from That 70s Show.
Oh, my God.
He was the president of the Federation in 6.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Kirkwood Smith was...
I'm going to have to go back and watch that abortion of a movie and just...
No, 6 is good.
Or not... I'm going to have to go back and watch 5 and 6.
Why?
Just so I can
Why
catch
5?
This stuff. Well, because, you know, you got to know where you're pulling yourself out. Anyway, we're at the end of our time, Josh.
No, we're not. We got 45 seconds.
Thanks a lot for joining us this week.
We're not gonna. I'm dragging this shit out. You're the one that's always fucked around before. We gonna go right to 55.
I know.
So, go to AdamandEve.com. Use the promo code STATIC and get all the free stuff and the extra stuff. And, you know, making somebody come. There's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
There's nothing wrong with making yourself
come. Whether it's yourself or somebody else or you know, friends.
And AdamandEve.com has a classic section. They got all the Debbie Does Dallas movies there.
That's true.
You might, or the Debbie Does movies. Check them out.
That's right.
All right. Next week, Next Generation.
We've got 5 seconds left. Do you have anything to say?
So now you're...